All right, hi, so my name's Andy Bissett.
I'm James Allen.
And this is the Ball Chat Sports Podcast.
All right, so welcome to episode number 31 of the Ball Chat Sports Podcast. I am back in New York now, Jim. So we're back to doing it virtually like we were a few months ago.
Well, first things first, happy birthday, Bissett. What are you 42? 43, is it?
43, yeah. Getting on a bit. Having an early birthday drink, 9:30 in the morning, but it doesn't matter when you're your birthday, does it really?
First and foremost, I respect that. And you're not hiding it either. You're not like putting it in a Starbucks coffee cup. I would always be tempted to do.
I've got no shame. Yeah. Well, you having a rum in that as well?
Oh, if only. Give it a few hours. I'll be on it, man. And apologies if you can hear the dog, because the next door neighbours have chose this specific moment to start moving things out of the garage, and he doesn't like shadows moving past the window.
So
if you can hear him tapping and crying, that's why.
He's a proper soft soul at heart, and your dog.
Doesn't matter, didn't it?
And so this is going to be a bit of, well, we were talking about trying to keep this episode short, but it might turn out to be a bit of a bumper episode because you're going to be away next week, aren't you? Where are you going?
Going to go to Penzance to whale watch. Hopefully we do that to see some aquamarine life.
All right, cool. So I'll probably do a little bit of an NFL preview next week. But we've got a lot of football, footy stuff to talk about this week. And we're going to start off the preamble ramble today with the Sterling racist abuse that occurred last night against Hungary. So, you know, when does it end, really? And when are the governing bodies actually going to crack down on it? And why on earth do we need to be told about Boris Johnson condemning it? As if, like, you know, the Prime Minister of England is going to condone it. Oh, yeah, you know what? That was warranted, that racist abuse last night. Why do we need to hear about people condemning things?
Well, it's always good to get yourself on side when it comes to the racial debate, innit? But obviously, you're not going to stop countries that don't like black people from being racist. Like, they were unashamed. Do you know what I mean? When the white players scored, they weren't bothered. When Sterling scored, they were like hammering him with cups and abuse and all that. Like, it was vitriolic. But it's to be expected, man. If you're going to hold away games in places where they know they've got a dodgy racial reputation, then it's going to happen, isn't it?
And now it's in the template of UEFA when they sort of get round to punishing these teams. And it's usually like a £50,000 fine and two games behind doors. That's not gonna stop the fans from doing it again, is it?
Nah, not at all, man. Like, at the end of the day, the fans are back in the stadiums. There's money to be made. Like, at those penalties are negligible anyway. So, like, there's no deterrent for it. I rate what all the team did. Like, they didn't look outraged. They just kind of looked like they expected it as well. So let's just get on with it, and it look, you know.
Yeah, it did slightly, you know. It made me feel a little bit sad, to be honest, because there was a clip where Sterling went down in the box and it wasn't a penalty. He went down quite easily and he looked up to the referee initially, and then he heard the sort of like monkey chants coming from behind the goal, and he just looked around and he wasn't angry. He was just like almost like disappointed, like exasperated.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And just the look on his face, I just felt like, what on earth, man? This shouldn't be happening like in 2021.
I rate Sterling for that, because he's looking at them like, yous are just stupid, man.
Yeah, stupid people.
Like, so far beyond anger. And that, to me, demonstrates a maturity and an understanding of the situation. You're above it. Do you know what I mean? And now, it depends on whether you think that's the right approach to take. But if that was happening to me, I'd be like, mate, yous are the divs here, not me, man. Do you know what I mean? So you're securing your position at that point. So rate Sterling for a number of reasons, not just the goal, but for his reaction to that as well.
Definitely. And, you know, the more and more he scores against racists, the more and more we're going to like love what he's doing. So I just think, you know, I don't know when it's going to end or how we sort of get to a point where the fans of these teams, and I'm sure it is only a small minority, it's the ultras, isn't it, in the sort of like, that's what they say. And it seems to only be a certain area of the ground, just behind the goal in that corner. And they're the ones that were pelting him with stuff. But I love the fact that, I think it was Grealish and Declan Rice were like drinking out of the cups. So they were picking up the cups that they'd thrown and they were like pretending to drink out of it. I think that's one way to try and combat it. Do you know what I mean? Sort of, you know, make it quite trivial and, you know, as if you were not affected by it. So why are you doing it? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a good method to undermine someone's anger, is to just make fun of it and belittle it as much as you can. Right. But our Jack would do anything for a drink anyway, wouldn't he? So,
definitely.
And, just first.
And it reminds me of when I think it was Barcelona versus, I can't remember who they're playing. It was in the Spanish La Liga. And Danny Alves had just scored, or he was he was about to take a corner, and somebody had threw a banana at him on the pitch. Not a skin, a full banana. So he actually peeled the banana and started eating it just before he took the corner. And I thought, that is brilliant, man. That is the way to approach, like, you know, racist acts, I think, definitely.
He doesn't want to waste food either. Rate him on all corners, man.
And so the away fans actually gave him that little energy boost they needed to put that corner in the box. All right, so that's a short preamble ramble to talk about such a big topic in the world of football. But we're going to move on to the five things you might have missed. Starting off with Jack Grealish, Segway City, new Manchester City starlet Jack Grealish was pictured celebrating the 5-0 win over Arsenal at Leeds Festival Saturday night. British rapper and Manchester United fan Stormzy brought the £100 million man onto the stage as a guest of honour. He was spotted by festival goers throughout the day before taking to the stage for Stormzy's late set Saturday evening. Do you reckon these two actually chill together, or do you reckon it's a bit of a publicity stunt?
I get the feeling that Jack Grealish doesn't know what's going on half the time, other than when he's on a football pitch. He's an absolute magician on the pitch. Whenever you see him interviewed or doing anything else, he just looks like, what's going on? Clueless, yeah. Like... fish out of water.
Have you seen that one where I think he's talking to Laura Woods and what are they talking about? They're talking about like something and like he just hasn't got a clue what she's on about. Like I think it was like an encyclopedia. I think it might have been, it was like, what's an encyclopedia? It's just so like dumb. But like on the football pitch, he's a fucking genius. Like
he stares through people. He just looks like he's biding his time until he can just kick a ball again, which is like really endearing. Not that biased or anything.
Everything in between, like his life between playing football, he's just like a means to an end, isn't it?
From that one on to number two, man. You highlighted this to me. It seems like good news for boxing fans, but it might not be. The WBA have scrapped their interim belts, which is, they're the most egregious offenders in terms of sanctioning bodies and having all like interim, normal champ, super champ, gold champ, all that kind of stuff. So what they've tried to do to appease fans is to get rid of their interim titles and put more emphasis on the gold title. So there are currently 10 interim champions, including fighters from the UK, Daniel Dubois at heavyweight and Chris Eubank Jr. at middleweight. So what they're essentially doing is, well, what they say they're doing is getting rid of one rung on the ladder of championship titles. But they're only doing that to strengthen their gold title, which is going to function in the same way as the interim champion. So to me,
there's interim, the interim champion, then a gold champion, then the actual champion at the moment.
Yeah. So the top fighter for the WBA is called the super champion. And it's like, it's just a way for them to pump sanctioning fees out of people and to, for promoters and fighters to buy their way up the rankings. And everyone knows that, who knows how it all works. So what they're doing is they're making a pretty much an empty gesture to appease fans. And they're even saying, we're not happy about doing this. But we're going to do it because the fans want it. When really, they're just going to switch out the interim for the gold championship. It's like a same shit sandwich, different bread. That's pretty much what it is. They're just corrupt, aren't they? I don't care how much they try and like glad hand the fans. I don't care. They're a bunch of fucking absolute criminals, man.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to make anybody more interested in watching these big title fights. Obviously, you know, in boxing, you're going to watch the fighter more than you are, you know, going to watch a big title fight, because they sometimes come hand in hand, don't they? Or most of the time they probably do, innit? You're usually probably looking out for the fighter because you want to watch him because of his style, because of his sort of like media appeal, what he's been doing, you know, how he's been sort of fighting. So, you know, it's not going to really make much of a difference, is it?
I wish they could just like make it into like the Death Star and all the evil sanctioning bodies can come together and they can all take the little cut of the pie. They can all bleed all the fighters together. Do you know what I mean? Get on that side of things. But it's just, I don't know, everyone wants their own piece of the pie. Everyone wants to be the top dog in it. So I don't see it ending anytime soon at all.
Yeah. And number three, so there was a 4-way photo finish in the men's Paralympics T64 100 meter final in Tokyo. What has been suggested is the greatest race of this nature in Olympics history. Johnny Peacock took a share of bronze, which is a great name, by the way, for Great Britain,
that great name.
With German Johannes Flores, as they couldn't be separated by a thousandth of a second. The two-time Paralympic champion Peacock was edged by another German, Felix String, and Costa Rican Sherman Isidiro Gitti Gitti. So these are just great names. Like, honestly, they got amazing names. And he took the silver. There was only 0.03 of a second separating the top four as the winning time came in at 10.76, which is incredibly fast considering most of these guys are either a double amputee or a single amputee. So I just think it's incredible that they can even run in that time. All in all, I think this has to be considered a great advert for the Paralympic Games.
I would think that those, what are they called? The blades?
Blade runners.
They look like they would make you go faster than actual legs.
I think that was what's his name? Oscar Pistorius. I think he had, some, I don't know how you can say, or somebody came out
sensitively.
Yeah. But like, people were coming out and saying that he was kind of cheating in a way because of the blades that he had. And they are actually probably making him quicker than he would be perhaps if he had legs. There was a lot of controversy surrounding that. But now I suppose everybody across the board, they probably get their blades made by different manufacturers, but there must be specifications on what they can or cannot do. And I guess they have to be passed off by the Olympic governing body to do the Paralympics. So,
yeah, having an unfair advantage over the field is probably the worst thing Oscar Pistorius has ever done. So let's just move on from that one.
Yeah, it must be. Number four, Bryson DeChambeau. Is Bryson DeChambeau losing the plot? In the last few months, he's parted ways with his caddy, who quit his $1 million salary to start up a bus company. He's had feuds with the suppliers of the clubs who basically called him a child and impossible to work with. And now last weekend, after blowing the lead at the BMW Championship, was asking Patrick Cantlay to stop walking when he was about to take his approach shot. And then he refused all interview requests after becoming the first man in history to shoot a 27 under par over 72 holes and not win. So this guy... He's had a bit of a meltdown in the last sort of 12 months.
I imagine the golfing world is quite constrained in terms of the routine and what's expected of you, especially when it comes to the media. We spoke before about Naomi Osaka and how that can become quite claustrophobic. And if he's like some working class beer swiller who just likes to do his own thing and he just happens to be good at golf, I can imagine that would wear on you after a certain amount of time. And he's been a pro for a long time now, isn't it? So now that he's getting some clout and getting some authority, maybe he's just thinking, I don't have to do this shit. Why would I bother? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, he's probably one of the most polarizing figures in golf at the minute. I definitely wouldn't say he was working class. I mean, I'm not 100% sure on that, but I can't imagine there's many golfers that come from working class backgrounds anyway.
I'm stereotyping that DeChambeau is like a Louisiana working class name. I just picture him on his front porch with the Christmas lights on in March, swilling Coors Light.
See, that's funny because I can picture him like, you know, growing up with a silver spoon in his mouth. Do you know what I mean? So there you go.
We have to email him.
That's why. Yeah, I guess that's why we shouldn't really judge people based on their names.
Nah, I love it. Yeah, number five, my closet favorite sport. So in the second round of the US Open, Stefanos Tsitsipas was roundly booed for taking a toilet break. He'd already taken an 8-minute break against Andy Murray in the opening round and took 7 minutes here against Adrian Mannarino. And for some reason, this was deemed excessive by the crowd. I just thought to myself, what if he's got the shits, man? What if he's playing through an actual illness? What if he's got something where he's pushing through? Maybe he's on the Imodiums and he just has to go take a toilet break for 7 or 8 minutes. So what's the problem?
I don't know. I mean, I know all about the shits following that lamb vindaloo I had a few nights ago at Monsoon's Curry House. Serves me right for not bidding farewell to the Mermaid. But
speaking of monsoons.
But Murray was like, I think he was pretty upset about this, wasn't he? I'm sure this was in the paper, like at the start of the week, like moaning so much, saying it's kind of like almost like tactical. I mean, if you need to take a shit, that is tactical. Of course you do. You know what I mean? You can't be playing if you're desperate for a shit. But I'm not sure exactly what he's doing in there, but.
The cynic in me thought straight away, what if he's using that break to take some sneaky PEDs or something? What if he's taking like a banned substance? That's where my mind immediately went to. But then I thought, genuine, he could just be playing through an illness. So I'm not sure what side I fall on. But also, Andy Murray's been a crying little baby, man. He's fell off, isn't he? His best days are behind him. It's all good, man. Sour grapes, man. I don't like sour grapes at all.
Never rated him. Right, so that's it for the five things that you might have missed. We're going to move on to the football stuff, which is going to be loads of different facets to it. We've got sort of a review of the Champions League draw. We have some transfer roundup, and we're going to start off talking about Barcelona and how much of a shambles they are. Really, they've basically lost the best player to ever grace the game, or one of. on a free transfer because of their ineptitude at the management level, really. And now they've had to loan out Antoine Griezmann, who they signed from Atletico just 2 years ago for 60 million less. And they've brought in Luke de Jong, who struggled at Newcastle. And they've had to ask club legends to take pay cuts so they can register an injured and potentially washed up Sergio Aguero. I think they're an absolute shadow of their former selves. And it's like really a crash course in how not to manage a football club, isn't it, from the Barcelona owners.
Well, can you see them tumbling down the table, realistically? Below Real Madrid and Atletico, can you see them finishing much below there?
I can see another, probably, it probably won't happen straight away. Like, I can't see them finishing sixth this season because the La Liga, I don't think, is strong enough to be able to have teams that are going to compete. But I can see someone like Sevilla or Valencia, teams that have had, it's Real Sociedad, teams that have been knocking on that sort of like top three over the last few years. Obviously, I think Atletico and Real Madrid, I think they're almost guaranteed to beat Barcelona. To hit. So I'd say, you know, there's third. I could potentially see one more team that could have a good season that could push themselves into that bracket. But the thing is with the Spanish teams, and it's a lot like the French league, even when teams do well, like Lille, for example, they'll sell all their best players. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. They'll either, and it happens in the Bundesliga as well. RB Leipzig or Borussia Dortmund will finish second to Bayern or finish first. And then they'll sell all the players. Or RB Leipzig have sold Deo Upamecano. They've sold Ibrahima Konate, who's gone to Liverpool. So they sold their two best centre-backs, basically. Upamecano's gone to Bayern Munich. Their manager went to Bayern Munich. And I think there was another player that went there. So at the end of the day, there's a lot of these clubs that even if they have good seasons, the way they want to run their football club is, all right, we've had a great season. We haven't spent much money. Let's cash in on our players now while they're at their most valuable. They treat it almost like, football players are assets in a stock market. So this is the highest price that this player is going to get. And this is great value for what he is now. So let's sell him. Whereas Barcelona are almost doing the absolute opposite of that. They're basically taking players where, they're probably overpaying 3-4 times of what their actual market value is. And it's just been like mind-blowing, really. Coutinho, like they signed in for God knows how much, 120 million, was it, or something like that. They signed that French lad, what was his name? Dembele, Ousmane Dembele. They signed these players at extortionate fees. They haven't performed, and now they can't even like get rid of them because players won't take them because their wages are extortionate and they're just not going to pay any kind of fee for them. That they seem viable? I just don't understand it. It's just been an absolute shit show.
They've gone from paying a premium because of who they are as a club to struggling with the financial responsibility they've agreed to within a very short amount of time. It's not as if they've steadily been on the downslide for like 5-6 years where you could possibly make contingency plans.
Yeah.
It's literally been in the space of a year. But what I was getting at is I imagine that the Barcelona brand, like the badge, the club, the history, and as you mentioned, the lack of strength in La Liga, I think that could combine to keep Barcelona floating in the European spaces for long enough where they can steady the ship.
I would say they're probably 4 or 5 years away from, as you say, steadying the ship. They have so much, it seems they have so much financial problems to sort out. Like, it doesn't seem like they can immediately turn it around. I mean, they're going to start off front with Marcus Braithwaite, who is playing at Middlesbrough, Luke de Jong, and Sergio Aguero as their strikers, and Memphis Depay. Like, that isn't a Barcelona, like, lineup, is it? Attacking lineup.
Aguero, even on, like, an off day, is pretty ruthless striker. But Luke de Jong, I think that's appalling. I think Braithwaite had a pretty good Euro, so you could make a case for him doing semi-well. And then
he's done well since he's been there, to be fair. He has played well, but he's not like a marquee name. And Barcelona, in the last, 25, 30 years, they've always been a team that have, if they want the best player in the world, they'll get him. Do you know what I mean? And I don't think they're at that level now.
I think there are certain comparisons to draw between Barcelona and Arsenal in terms of what they, I don't think Arsenal were anywhere near as prestigious as Barcelona were in their pomp in the last 10, 15 years. But there are definite parallels there as to how the investments they've made, the poor recruitment strategy, just the general management of the club, and then the deterioration on the pitch, which is, you know, supposed to be first and foremost. And I just think, like, it's really underwhelming to see these quote-unquote big... Obviously, Barcelona's a massive club, but, you know, it's just... Football from the outside seems so simple, and I don't know how it gets dragged off track in this manner so often. You know what I mean?
No, I get that completely. I think the comparison with Arsenal is fair, because Barcelona potentially, it could go either way. Obviously, there's a likelihood that they will recover, purely based on their market appeal and sort of their brand, as you intimated to. They're not just a football club, are they? They've got basketball teams, hockey teams. You know, the Barcelona brand is very, very strong, and I think they will always have that sort of like connection with Messi and all the sort of great players they've had over the years. But it's fair to say that Barcelona could do an Arsenal. You know what I mean? And Arsenal, obviously, at the moment, bottom of the league, spent the most amount of money in the transfer window, as we're going to talk about a little bit later. But let's talk about things on the pitch with Arsenal at the minute, because watching that Man City game the other day was painful. That's not an understatement. An understatement actually is, because they were absolutely painful to watch.
Mate, I told you, man. I knew the game was coming on at 12:30. The lads were all talking, you're going to watch and all that. I took the dog for a walk. I'm not interested in watching my team get raped by Man City. It's not a way to make my Saturday enjoyable. I knew what was going to happen, man. And you know what gets me as well? I watched the highlights, and obviously, I'm not a sadist. I'm not up for 90 minutes of pain. But I watched people's reactions. And like Arsenal fans TV... And like all that kind of feedback from the Arsenal fans, they're so delusional, man. They're so delusional. It's like they expect Arsenal to get a result at a Man City at this point with the way things stand. It's like, what are you on about? All of them were like, oh, I can't believe this has happened. Yeah, maybe 2-1, maybe 3-1. I was thinking, I said, you're off your heads, man. Do they not see what's going on? Think about that second goal. How does that ball make it all the way through and then just tap it in? What about... Gundogan for the first goal. How does he win that header? It's a shit show all over the park, man. But you can give us more detail because you watched the full game and you was giving me... I was beginning to dread your updates after a little bit.
Mate, to be honest, it's getting to the point where, you know, I'm a Birmingham City fan. Obviously, we've had our fair share, say more than our fair share of like terrible moments like over the last sort of 10, 12 years or whatever. But Arsenal is getting on the point where it's looking almost as bad, man. And like there is a certain reality. I know we were sort of a little bit tongue in cheek a couple of weeks ago when we named our episode, could Arsenal really get relegated? But honestly, and the amount of money they've spent as well, they're in really perilous territory, man. Because if they did get relegated, they would be fucked. I'm not, you know, it's so early and we're so premature talking about it. But just even Arteta's, I'm at the point where I'm like, Arteta's almost certainly not the right man for the job. I think he got his tactics all wrong. Like, why would you high press Man City? You're basically playing into the hands. They're one of the best teams at building from the back in world football, if not the best. So why on earth would you high press? And then for the third City goal, they high pressed even when Xhaka had been sent off, which was a fucking terrible challenge. And like, isn't he the captain?
I said the whole time, I've always thought he was a liability for Arsenal, but he's had a tremendous Euros. I thought if he can summon some of that form for Arsenal, then, you know, if you can dominate the passing game in the middle of the park with the passes that he was pulling off for Switzerland, it's like you have an actual outlet to release your strikers. And I thought that was a really encouraging sign. But in big games, when you're taking a hammering and the last thing you want to do is stay on the pitch, to me, he looked for a way out. He didn't want to be on the pitch. And I think that's a load of shit, to be honest.
And it comes down to the fact that Arsenal haven't had real leaders for such a long time. You sort of like, who do you give the captain's armband to? How can you give it to somebody you need somebody on the pitch that's going to calm everyone down, even though it's 2-0 down, right, with 50 minutes, the game's almost lost. But you need to retain some dignity because Arsenal fans deserve at least to come off that field, you know, saying, all right, you know, we went 2-0 down early, we've lost 3-0, or lost 4-0, but at least we sort of battled, and at least we kept going and stuff, but I didn't see that at all.
There's none of that going on for Arsenal, man. It's so depressing.
But tactically, that third goal for me was just like, that kind of was like, what is Arteta thinking? Because the high press shape, It looked like they were the bar football players. They were stood in positions with no real clue of where they were, and they were trying to dictate the ball. Perhaps that's what they're trying to do. And Ederson, who has the best distribution of the ball from any keeper I have seen in recent memory, like, they gave him the luxury of just playing a short pass along the floor through the middle of the field, where I think it was Gundogan had popped up and then could turn and then carry the ball into like a gaping hole. And it was just like, what are you doing? Like, you have to be aware of that. But like, I guess that's where probably Xhaka would have been had he not been sent off. He probably would have pressed. He would have pressed Gundogan and not allowed him to turn, which is the right thing to do. But like, is it naivety of the players that they're still setting up in the same shape as they would have when Xhaka's off the ball? Is it Arteta's problem because he hasn't readjusted the tactics, which I think you should do if you've gone a man down, to be honest, shouldn't you? I think that's something you should immediately do. If you've lost a centre midfielder, that's the logical thing to do, is immediately take an attacking player off and put someone into his role that can do exactly what Xhaka was doing on the field.
I think Arteta falls into the trap of trying to replicate what he saw at City. But the problem is, he hasn't got that quality of player. He hasn't got the strength and depth. He hasn't got the inventiveness that Pep Guardiola's got. So it's like imitation, but with no substance. Do you know what I mean? And you're going to get battered by City if you try and high press them, like you say, man. They're just going to retain the ball in tight areas, and then they're going to break that space wide open behind you, and then you're fucked. I don't know, man. It's you say the talk about relegation's premature, but reputations and your club badge and all that stuff, it ain't going to save you if you're playing like shit. Yeah, if a new coach comes in, okay, there might be that initial period where people are like amped up and the players have a little bit of more zip about them, and they're not as depressed and maybe a little bit optimistic. Maybe you have a good run at games, but the problems are still there, man. Do you know what I mean? The team, I can't believe how much money they've spent and who they've got in. I don't know who's in charge of recruitment. I don't know if it's Arteta. I don't know if it's someone else. Or I know there's a whole team.
I'm not sure who the director of football is at Arsenal. I'm not 100% sure about how they're set up in terms of like their transfer policy. But yeah, it's been fucking piss poor for so many years now.
I want to be fair and mention that Arsenal have had a pretty challenging fixture list this early in the season as well. So what we're seeing right now is maybe not reflective of what we're going to see. We've got Norwich next week after the international break. Maybe we'll see. But if, you know, we had Brentford opening day. So it's not as if...
Yeah, it's not as if you've played four... What is it, three games now? Three games in or four games in?
Norwich would be the fourth. So
yeah, so it's not as if you played... Yeah, Chelsea, Man City and Brentford.
That's not the best run. We'll see.
You'd expect Arsenal to pick up 4 points. You'd expect 4 points from their three games.
Well, I don't know what I'd expect from them. I'd definitely expect to get beat by City and by Chelsea. Maybe nick something against Chelsea, Derby and all that. But this Norwich game is pretty important, man. If they can put something together, put a few passing moves, score a goal would be nice.
Yeah,
that'd be good, wouldn't it?
-9 goal difference already at the start of the season. That's going to be tough to get back. That's not going to take... Yeah. That's going to take 5 games to get back, even if they're playing well. But that, you know, that Norwich game coming up after the international break is so important for Arteta. If they lose that game, he's going to be under mountains of pressure, because he already looked exasperated. Like that is the best way to describe him. Helpless and like tactically completely out of his depth.
I think he's gone already, man, to be honest with you. I think they're just lining up the next guy. I think he's on borrowed time as it is.
I think he would have to do something special in the next, say, 4 or 5 games. I think he'd have to probably win, you know, at least 3 of those, maybe even 4 of the next 5 games, or else he's looking down the barrel of the gun, basically.
Honestly, I feel like this podcast is turning into the Arsenal Woes podcast, man. Let's talk about some other teams. Let's talk about some actually like successful clubs for a bit.
Football vibes. Well, Chelsea, they held on to a 1-1 draw, didn't they? Reece James playing handball on the line and resulting red. The talk of Tino's 30th.
Yeah, he was on the big screen, wasn't it? Everyone was talking, there was that Cockney lad and he was like,
oh, yeah,
Chelsea
yeah.
the whole time. And I remember talking about that handball and whether it should or shouldn't have been a red card with about 6 different people. And for me, it was definitely a red card, 100%, man. That is intentional handball on the line, preventing a goal. That's just standard. But you know what? Chelsea did well to cling on, man, because Liverpool looked like they were going to start going through the gears as that game went on.
It's a good result for him.
Proper, man.
You know, Chelsea's still sort of, rattling on. They're looking like they're definitely going to be contenders this year. I think Liverpool also getting back to some semblance of form. and looking like the team they were 2 years ago. But Spurs as well, third 1-0 win in a row. So they've won three games, 1-0. How would you rate their chances of, you know, potentially going all the way?
The only thing that stops me considering Spurs as title challengers is they always falter. If everyone stays fit, they've got every chance. Do you know what I mean? Harry Kane, we saw the other night that he's exhibiting similar problems that he did in the Euros. One sec, the dog's going mad. Zig, in your bed, man. Shut up. Sorry. So against Hungary, he looked like more of the player that he used to be, making good runs, good passes, but the finishing wasn't quite there.
Yeah, he could have had a hat trick, couldn't he? Obviously, he had that header. But last night, he was put for on goal, I think, by Grealish once, and I think it might have been Sterling for the other one. Yeah, he definitely, prime Harry Kane would have bagged a hat trick there, wouldn't he?
Yeah. And as the season goes on, maybe he recaptures that form, but the minute, I think they're relying on Son quite a lot. So, I don't know, it depends. There's no reason why they can't, but I think you're dealing with a different calibre of team when it comes to City, Chelsea and United and Liverpool. And I think those are the teams that you got to back going forward, man.
What about United? Obviously, they had a pretty lucky 1-0 win against Wolves, didn't they?
Yeah, definitely. There was that dodgy moment against Ruben Neves where Pogba's kind of gone through and clipped his shin on the way past. It was a foul, man. That was a foul. I know it happened pretty quickly. I don't think it should have been a red card. He did look like he dove in with 2 feet a little bit recklessly, but he didn't make much contact other than clipping his shin. But that was a definite foul. And Greenwood on the score sheet again to save a few points for his team. He's coming into his own, isn't he? Young Greenwood.
Oh, 100%, man. Like, three goals in three games, is that now? So, like, you know, obviously he didn't get picked for England, I think, because he was injured. I think he did get a late injury or whatever. But he wasn't in the squad this time around either, was he?
Nah, a bit weird. How old is he now? Like 19, 20, something
19,
like that.
19, and he's performing really, really well for Man United. It'd be interesting to see what happens now, like, Ronnie's come in. Because he's obviously, I'd imagine he's going to play Cavani's position because I think he's took his shirt number. I think, which is like, obviously, you're saying nothing, are you? You're saying nothing to Cristiano Ronaldo. If he wants your shirt number, if he wants that number 7, or was it Sancho that had, I don't know who it was. It was either Cavani or Sancho that had number 7. And like, Ronnie's just come in and been like, I'm having 7.
If Ronnie wants to get in bed with your missus, you tuck him in, didn't you? You
know what I mean? Yeah, exactly. So, it'd be interesting to see tactically how Solskjaer you sort of works that around, because obviously he's going to start. Like, you're not going to not start Cristiano Ronaldo. And he was just unbelievable the other night against Republic of Ireland. Oh, my God. Like, honestly, if that doesn't cement his legacy as being the greatest, one of the greatest footballers of all time, I don't know what, because he does it all the time. Like, he's missed a penalty, right? He was on the verge of becoming the highest international goals for all time. And then he's got that dogged determinedness, if that's a word, to just get up there and just score two goals late on. Do you know what I mean? He hates losing, doesn't he?
He's got the focus, the concentration, the self-belief, the fitness, the ability. He's the full package. And to see him keep churning out these kind of game-changing actions, like these contributions for his country and his club, wherever he happens to be, it's just like I'm blown away by him myself, and I think United have got him. The circumstances that they've received him in have been advantageous to them, because I feel like he's got something to prove now, and he's the last person other teams will want to play against if he's got something to prove. So he's going to be doing a lot of damage to a lot of teams this year. I know, like, you can't stop the clock and all that kind of stuff, but I think he's going to have at least a good season or two left in him.
Yeah, because people are saying, "Oh, yeah, but he's 36." I was like, but this guy, like, he's not your average 36-year-old. Yeah. He's not even your average 36-year-old athlete. He's a freak. Like, his body and the way he trains and, you know, what he can do physically, like, is, like, akin to the average 28-year-old sportsman or footballer. So I would not choose many 28-year-olds in world football that I would say, oh, he's fitter than him, or, like, he's got more technical ability than him.
I remember watching a Real Madrid training video before, and they're all going through press-ups and all that, and all the rest of the lads are just doing normal press-ups at a decent pace, and Ronnie's doing clapping press-ups at twice the speed of everyone else as, like, a finisher.
A little warm-down, like.
what does he do on a daily basis to maintain? Oh, it's just mind-boggling to me. I'm so glad he's back in the Premier League.
He's like a robot, man. He's like a robot. Like, he's the closest thing. If we, in the future, in 100 years, when people can't be bothered to play football physically anymore and we're just watching robots, like, we'll remember Ronaldo and be like, you know what? That's what Ronaldo was like.
Just model it after him.
So. Yeah, do you know what I mean? So he's just incredible. Well, we're going to quickly talk about the Champions League draw. Where do we see certain teams doing well? Which is the group of death? And I think there's one that sticks out for me. Obviously, Man City with Paris Saint-Germain and RB Leipzig in their group and Club Brugge, who are no mugs. So they've got a tough group for once. Man City usually get some favourable draws, don't they?
It's not as bad as Sheriff Tiraspol in Group D. We've got Inter Milan, Real Madrid and Shakhtar Donetsk to deal with. You can be the kings of Moldova all you want, man, but you're going to get absolutely spanked in that group, man.
Is that where they're from, Moldova?
Yeah, yeah. This is what I like about the Champions League, is that you'll have like three recognisable teams and one of them will just be like, where'd they come from again? And then it's just like 4-0, 4-0, 5-0.
Yeah, you get the odd teams that somehow manage to like sneak in. I'm not sure how they do it in the lower rungs of the European leagues, like how they figure it out. I guess whoever finishes top in each of the European leagues. But I didn't even know, like, are you sure they're from Moldova? I didn't even know Moldovan teams could make it into the Champions League.
It's an all-inclusive tournament, isn't it? Smashing it.
They probably have to go through qualifying, even though they finish top in their European league. They probably have to play like top in the Slovenian league or something like that, and it's like in sort of a sort of qualifier for the Champions League.
But man, you've had a good draw.
Yeah.
They've got Young Villarreal. Boys, Atalanta and Villarreal, and a spicy little rematch with Villarreal from the Europa League last year. So that's a nice little...
It's going to be interesting. It's going to be an interesting draw, but I like easing on what Liverpool have managed to end up with, which is Atletico Madrid, Porto and AC Milan. Every single team in that bracket has won a Champions League trophy. I don't know if there's been any group. I'd like to see if there's ever been a group stage where that's happened before, where every team in the group has won a European trophy previously. I'm not sure if it's ever happened.
And at AC Milan, extra dangerous because they've got handsome Olivier Giroud, who's absolutely killing it for him. I was watching the highlights the other night. Back heels galore, penalty, left foot finishes first time, curling it round the keeper, saying nothing, man.
You know what I mean? Still got it at his age. And then you got Benfica, Barcelona, Bayern. That could potentially be a banana skin for Barcelona. You know, imagine if they didn't qualify from that.
Yeah, usually you'd fancy Barcelona to go through, but look at the squad they're rocking now. There's no guarantees for them at all, man. I'll be watching that one. But I think you'd expect Bayern to go through top there. But you wouldn't take it as a given that Barcelona's going to beat Benfica, really, not at this stage.
Nah. And then you've got sort of some of the easier groups, like Group G, obviously, because Lille won the Ligue 1 last year. They've gone through as a top seed and they're playing Sevilla, Salzburg and Wolfsburg. So, you know, there's potential there for two teams to get through. And, you know, there's going to be a couple of easy rounds. I'd say easy, but a favourable sort of round of 16 ties against some of the big boys. So we'll press on. We'll talk about, because we've got a lot of sort of the roundup of the transfer window, which I would say has probably been the most exciting transfer window for many a year that I can remember anyway, with the sort of the big two players, Messi and Ronaldo, moving on. You've had a lot of transfer speculation. And also you've had some big money transfers. So obviously big run back to United has to be the main talking point, along with Messi, the prodigal son. What about another prodigal son, Troy Deeney, going back to Birmingham City, a team where he said he'd never, ever play for, right? And he's got a Birmingham City tattoo on his leg and he's gone back to Blues, took a huge pay cut to go there. You know, it's not about the money, he said. It's all about him going back to a team, and he wants to bring us back to the Premier League and make us a team again, make us a community club. And that he spoke a lot about that sort of thing. And it's almost as if, you know, he's not just going back as a player, man. He's going back as almost like an ambassador for the club, which I absolutely love. And I haven't seen anything like it from Blues in the sort of last, you know, 10 or so years since we were, you know, a decent club. And it's getting back. It feels like that's a great move from the owners to bring him in. And that's going to be, you know, it's going to be massive kudos to them. And it's going to really sort of reinvigorate the Blues fans about what Birmingham City is all about.
You know, it made me smile when he's like, I want to bring it back to when it was like a pound for a kid to get in on like on a Saturday. He's like, back to them days. And that, and like, he even speaks like a proper Brummie. And you can tell that I haven't followed Troy Deeney in any capacity, really. But you could feel that it was genuine, like the warmness towards it. Like, he's saying, people have doubted me because of my injuries. He's like, basically, I'm on pennies to come here. This isn't a cash grab for me. And I think that's something, from what you've told me, that's something Blues have lacked, a feeling of connection with the club. Basically, players are coming in, managers are coming in, and they're almost like mercenaries. And that changed a little bit with Boya. And you can see the positive results that have come as a consequence of his appointment. But I feel like if you can get more players like Deeney with that kind of attitude on the pitch, then, you know, it's not going to be smooth sailing because the Championship's absolute like a nightmare to get out of. So much competition week in, week out. Everyone's scrapping for their lives. But if you've got someone who's got a goal, like a definite goal, we want to get promoted. And sometimes people get scared to even say things like that. So it's good. It's a positive move as far as I can see.
And he won't be able to do anything wrong. Like, the fans absolutely love him. Ben Foster was on a podcast last week, and he was saying that when him and Deeney were at Watford and they used to go to play Villa away, they'd stay in like the city, stay in Birmingham in a hotel overnight, and they'd sort of like go for a walk around the city or whatever. And people would come up to Ben Foster, who I think has got over 100 appearances for Blues, won a Carling Cup with them. And they'd always like go up to Troy Deeney and be like, oh, Troy, we absolutely love you. A guy that's never played a minute for Blues, but they'd be like, oh, Blues fans absolutely love you. Like, you should come back. Like, when you're coming back, like, have you been to any Blue games recently? And they'd be like, oh, you're right, Ben.
And Ben,
he was like, mate, I've played like 100, over 100 times for you. Like, I won a Carling Cup with you guys. Like, I was there for like 7 years or whatever. Like, just
he's like, nah, fuck off, mate. Where's Troy?
Don't care. All the one is Troy. But yeah, as you say, man, like, hopefully it's getting to a point where Birmingham City are starting to become like a proper club again. And I mean that by, you know, as you say, like, getting people in that actually care about the club and want the club to succeed and get back to a level where, right, we're a second city team, man. Like, we should be trying to get up into that Championship every year. And we haven't even had a sniff for the last like 9 years, man. We literally haven't had a sniff. And obviously we had a playoff run with Chris Hughton, I think, which was like 2014 or something like that. But that was probably the last time I think we've even got close. So obviously Craig Gardner's come in, done a great job as the sort of, I think he's the technical director. And he's brought in some great players. Like, that's a massive coup for Blues. And he's brought in this Tahith Chong from Manchester United on loan, who's been sensational already. So we've got, obviously, Boya and him have had a connection from their days at Blues. So they're starting to become a real sort of like Birmingham community, local connection there. So it's been, it's going to be interesting to see what they do. So we'll move on. And Mbappe says, so he stays at PSG despite loads of speculation that he's going to move to Real Madrid. I find it bizarre that the owners of PSG could turn down 180 million euro bid when this guy is open to start contract talks in 4 months. How much money must they have to be able to turn that down?
It's obscene, isn't it? I mean, they're literally bleeding the earth dry. So I imagine they've got untold billions. But in terms of a commercial decision, a business deal, it doesn't make much sense. And also, like, we're all speculating. What we get told by the mainstream media and all that, it's all speculation anyway. So we're only regurgitating what we're told. But I could imagine that he's the type of guy that doesn't want to play second fiddle to anyone. He's been so hyped for so long, been on the cover of FIFA games and, you know, just like lauded as the next guy. I can imagine he doesn't want to be overshadowed by like a 35-year-old Messi. I can really see that happening.
Do you think that's part of the reason why he was really trying to push for a move? Because he doesn't want his legacy, like Mbappe's own legacy and his ability or his market value or his presence in the footballing world and how he's perceived. He doesn't want that to be diluted by Messi coming in and saying, you know, say if they won the Champions League. If they win the Champions League this year, it's going to be Messi. It's going to be all about Messi.
Definitely.
Isn't it?
Yeah, of course.
Messi is the reason that he won. Same with the Copa America when he's won the Copa America with Argentina. It's not, oh, all the players are, you know, that have come in and probably done a really good job. It's going to be Messi won the Champions League, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, never mind the fact that by spending time with Messi and training with him and talking to him and getting tips about things, Mbappe will improve as a player if he's open to that process. But he strikes me as a man with a fragile ego. He really does. I know he's only a young kid. I know he's only like 22 or something. There's plenty of time for him to develop into something more mature and more secure in himself. But I do think that's part of it. So I hope... I can't see him not smashing it. Like, he played the other night and he looked unreal again. But again, it's the French league, man. I don't trust, like, anyone. It's like when Neymar was playing in Brazil. Looked like an absolute... He looked like an alien. Just like the ball... gravitational field around his feet. Once you step up into like mainstream European competitions and the toughest leagues in the world, it's not that easy, man. So
Griezmann to Atletico's another big one, really, in terms of like their sort of like, you know, sustainability or as a sort of a leading figure in La Liga. And obviously they've been really consistent under Diego Simeone for quite a few years now. I think
A couple of
La Liga titles, isn't it? I think there's two La Liga titles.
Champions League
and another final. So and I imagine a couple of Copa del Rey's in there as well. So it's you know, they're their business has been really good as well, hasn't it? You know what I mean? So obviously bringing Luis Suarez, was it Suarez they brought back in? Wasn't it? Yeah, and
no,
then,
they brought back Diego Costa. They had Suarez.
Costa, yeah.
After he was at Barca, they brought back Fernando Torres when apparently his best days were done. They squeezed a few more extra seasons out of him. And now they're going to, I think they'll get the best out of Griezmann, because Atletico Madrid strike me as a team that they're not too proud to sign a player who's probably just past his peak. And I think Simeone, you know what he's like, man. He's like a pit bull, man. He's going to drag every last ounce out of his players. And I think you're going to see a different caliber. Like Griezmann at Atletico was amazing. He goes to Barcelona. Looks so-so. Looks good, but so-so. And I think the environment will benefit him a bit more. And also, to just get out of that Barcelona swamp, innit? It's all too messy over there. Could excuse the pun.
All right, so we're going to run through the sort of Premier League teams and sort of grade them real quick. We're going to try and blast through this. I'll give a sort of an overview of the team, and I want you to tell me what you think their grade is. I've got some of the grades written down, but we're going to go through in alphabetical order. So Arsenal spent by far the most in the Premier League this window, have arguably a worse team at the end of last season. Once again, miss out on big targets. And sorry, Jim. And can't find bargains around Europe where it seemed like they were screaming out to everyone else. Ben White feels like a lot of money for a relatively unproven player. We still don't know what Odegaard can bring to the table. And they have signed unproven Premier League players apart from Ramsdale, who should be the number one after international break. So what do you think and what grade would you give him?
I think all things told, you got to give him a D, especially if you're letting people like Hector Bellerin go to Real Betis on loan. What does that say? And it's like William wants to go. Maitland-Niles wants to go.
Yeah, William, he took a massive... I think he shredded up his contract. I think it was worth 20 million. And as a sort of gesture to Arsenal, and I suppose gesture to the fact he's been so poor at Arsenal, he shredded up his contract and saved him £20 million, which I think is incredible, really.
Yeah, it is incredible. But at the same time, that shows you what he thinks about Arsenal as a club. Okay, he thinks a lot about them, but he knows he's not winning anything. He's abandoning ship. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, he's gone back to somewhere in Brazil, not Santos. Might be the one that begins with C. Can't remember. But he's gone back. I think it's Corinthians. He's gone back to Brazil. Obviously, that shows you, as you say, he doesn't want to sit at Arsenal for 2 years and get a paycheck. He'd rather scrap his contract and play. Yeah. So
at least in Brazil, you can like be a king on that like lower tier, can't you? There's no joy in being at Arsenal at the minute, and especially when you consider how much they've spent and the underwhelming pick. Like, come on, man. D or below for me, man.
Yeah, and I think they'll probably get the worst mark out of all of this. So Aston Villa, they've reinvested the money from Jack Grealish signing into three solid attacking options. Emi Buendia from Norwich, who I said was a player that Arsenal should have signed last season. Danny Ings has already come in good with goals, and he was a player that apparently Chelsea and Manchester United were interested in signing. And Leon Bailey has come in from Bayer Leverkusen, who looks a talent. He's looked good in the German Bundesliga. So they've reinvested that money into those three solid players, and they've sort of potentially made themselves a better squad than they were when Grealish was there. So what do you think? Well, I'd give them an A- Villa for their transfer window.
The only player out of them three that I'm familiar with is Ings, and I've rated him for years. So just on the basis of getting him in, plus the other two, like B and above, really.
All right, cool. So Brentford spent relatively little for a club promoted from the Championship, kept the core group that got them to the Premier League last season. The players they've signed have some Champions League experience mixed with a couple of wild cards that have clearly been brought in to bolster the squad. So relatively unknown players that Brentford have brought in. But I like the fact that they haven't spent much. They've had a pretty good start to the season. Obviously, beating Arsenal was a great result. What sort of score are you going to give them? What do you reckon? What grade for them?
Well, just based on results so far, you got to give them an A, ain't you?
Yeah.
Know what I mean? It's like you can't really fault their start to the season so far. I think they drew with Villa the other day as well, didn't they?
Yep. So a couple of good results.
They've started off well. Yeah, yeah.
Brighton, who were sort of our underdog of the season, but they had a bad result against Everton on the weekend. But Cucurella, who they've signed, could turn out to be a very good signing. They've signed industrious midfielder Enoch Mwepu from RB Salzburg, who played against Liverpool in Champions League last season. So once again, it'll be telling to see how these signings adapt in the Premier League. But I do believe Brighton are on the up.
I'm not sure how valuable my gradings are here because I'm familiar with these players through you. And obviously, if you're playing in the Champions League 1 year, that indicates some kind of quality. But there are a load of shoddy players who get games in the Champions League. So it's difficult for me to assess how good they're doing.
And it's always very, I would say, hit and miss with players coming from European leagues like Holland, Belgium, leagues that are outside that sort of top five that FIFA classes to being the big five. So it's very difficult to assess them sometimes, isn't it? We don't really know which way they're going to go. I'm going to go with a B for Brighton, I think. So I think they're going to have a good season. I think it's a pretty solid window, but we'll see how they progress. Burnley, I think, have made a few shrewd signings. Four British players alongside Ivorian Maxwell Cornet, I think, who's going to turn out to be I think he's their highest ever signing at 11 million. So it shows you how frugal Burnley have been with money over years, isn't it?
It's crazy that you can even sign a player for 11 million nowadays.
You know, this Maxwell Cornet can play anywhere down the flank as an attacking or defensive option, racked up over 150 appearances for Lyon and still only 24. So I feel like that's a pretty good sign. And along with some of the British players have signed, I think they signed a couple of players on a free, if I'm not mistaken. So I think Burnley, that's a pretty good window for them. Chelsea, I think signing Lukaku, game changer. They haven't really spent much else until the final day where they brought in Saul Niguez on loan from Atletico, I believe, who he's going to boost their midfield options even further. I think they did their business early, where they will be contending for a title this season, kept their sort of their real core squad. They haven't been a selling club for quite a few years under Roman Abramovich. So I think they've done really well to keep that squad, not sell anybody of note, I don't think. Although they probably wanted to sign Declan Rice for quite a few years. But I think Chelsea, I'll give them an A.
Yeah, definitely. And as well, in today's market, you're thinking like Lukaku, 97 million, was it? It's a steal, really. I mean, I know Van Dijk, Liverpool just look like a different team with Van Dijk back in there, don't they? And he put manners on Lukaku the other day. Even in the early goings, Chelsea didn't look quite as threatening as you might have hoped. But I still think against 95% of the other teams in the league, Lukaku is going to be doing some serious damage. That's a great signing for them.
100%. And I think Palace, they have been a sort of, I don't want to say a victim of Chelsea's sort of like selling factory line with their players that haven't made a single appearance for them, but selling them on for like, I think he might have been like 20 million, unless I'm mistaken. Mark Guehi, they spent a good chunk on him, who had a very good season with Swansea last season, don't get me wrong. But another player that comes off that Chelsea factory floor in their sort of recruitment policy of signing players when they're young, keeping them and, you know, sending them on loan, whether they have got 50 players on loan, and then making a profit on them. So Palace have also picked up Will Hughes, who for not very much, and he'll be looking to reinvigorate his career after a couple of years in the Championship under the radar, because he was sort of like looking like he was going to be, you know, the way Jack Wilshere was perceived when he was coming onto the scene, like at 21, 22. I think Hughes is like 26 now, and he has been under the radar a bit because he was looking like he was going to be one of those players that could be a potential England starter in the future. They've also signed Odson Edouard from Celtic, as they're another team that continue to sell their best players. And they were talking about wanting to be part of the bloody, the European Super League. Honestly.
Oh, that seems like a distant memory now, doesn't it, the Super League? Remember the whole hubbub, the hysteria surrounding that? Gary Neville squeaking the life out of every microphone he got in front of. And now it's not even a thing. People are funny, man. I don't know.
The people involved in football have the shortest memories out of anyone, because it's so easy to there's so many things that can captivate your attention and just like move you on. And like, all right, you know, Ronnie, Ronaldo's back. You know, that's it. You know what I mean? Nobody cares about anything, man. Ronaldo's back in the Premier League. Like, it's the best league in the world once again. It's just a shame that Messi stunted his legacy by going to PSG. But we'll give Palace a B. I think they look like they're going to have, they're going to be struggling, I think. And we'll see how Vieira does as coach. He's still a relatively unproven manager, but I can't see him getting relegated. So I think they'll probably be mid-table. Everton, I'm going to give them an A. They've had many transfer windows of splashing out millions on like a lot of high-profile names. James Rodriguez. I can't remember how much they spent him, but on the wages they must be giving him. But I think they've got this window absolutely spot on. They've brought in Damari Gray for only 1.7 million. That is criminal. It is absolutely criminal. I don't know how they've manufactured that deal.
Where'd they sign him from?
Bayer Leverkusen. He's only been there for about, I want to say, 12 months after he left Leicester. And he's already scored 2 goals in 3 games. I don't understand it, because he's a British player that's got English gaps. You know, he looked really good at Leicester when he got signed there, when they signed him from Birmingham. Yeah. So I can't believe that they've only paid 1.7 million for him. I think he'll probably get 10 plus goals this season for him. And he's going to be a starter for Everton. Who are probably looking to go into the top six. I just think it's unbelievable business. They've also brought in Andros Townsend on a free. And they bolster goalkeeping options with, I think, Andy Lonergan and that other guy that was at Stoke, Begovic. So I just think Everton, it has to be an A, doesn't it? Leeds, they've signed a player that has been integral for their success in recent years in Jack Harrison. Good value for money. Brought in a lad from Barcelona who not many will have heard of for a similar amount. Splashed out on Daniel James last game of the season, who will definitely prove their starting 11. And they, more importantly, they kept hold of their key players, Bamford, Rafinha. So, they've kept their core that they had last season. Leeds have been a bit of a funny team, really. They can either get hammered or they can hammer teams. You know what I mean? They seem to be sort of that sort of team, don't they?
Yeah, we spoke about that a lot last season, where like Bielsa is going to stick to his guns no matter what, come hell or high water. And you saw the downsides of that on the opening day against a resurgent Man United, where they got absolutely trounced. But I can imagine them putting a whooping on a few teams myself. Like, I think as soon as Bielsa goes from them, they're fucked, really. To be honest with you,
You think he's got that much influence in that club? That
look what he's done. There's a reason why Pep and so many other prominent managers look at Bielsa and say he's the godfather, he's the Michael Corleone of this shit. So like, bow down to him. And I think I'm not saying like Bamford and the lads are like bad players or they're a bad team collectively, but I feel like a man with a vision and determination and a willingness to upset people is quite an asset to have. So I hope for Leeds fans' sake, he can stay there for a long time. That's probably the coup, isn't it? Like not giving the coach up to a bigger team.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean? That potentially is the, and you know, we've spoke about before in the past about management transfer windows. So a manager can only move from a club during the same periods as the players can. And I think that would probably be quite interesting if they do ever. I don't think they ever will implement anything like that. So once again, it's do Leeds keep hold of their manager? Do you know what I mean? But I feel like he's quite, he's got quite a loyal nature, hasn't he, Bielsa? So I think he'll stick it out until either Leeds feel that they want to move him on, which I'm not sure is going to come as long as they stay in the Premier League. But, you know, I just can't see a scenario where he'll go to a big club.
I want him to go to Arsenal, man. He's exactly the man they need, I'm telling you. But enough of this fantasy land. Let's talk about what's actually happening.
Yeah, so we'll move on. I will probably give them a B. I think Leeds, that's probably about a B. So Leicester, who is another team that I think you could put in the B category. I like Vestergaard signing. Soyuncu, for me, their centre-back, their Turkish centre-back, looks a bit of a liability. And I thought Yannick Vestergaard had a great Euros. Boubacar Samir, is a promising young midfielder who played alongside Renato Sanchez to win the league on last season. Renato Sanchez is a player, once again, that I think Arsenal could have gone in for. I thought he had a great Euros. He's still young. He's got the bit between his teeth. He's just won a league title, picked PSG to it. And he was probably the best Portugal player for me. in that Euro. So I can't understand why nobody's broke the bank on him. And I don't think it even wouldn't have been have to broke the bank. I think somebody could have come in and paid 35 million quid for him, which is nothing nowadays. Money's worth nothing. Like, you know what I mean? In football nowadays, you don't get much bang for your buck. So Renato Sanchez for 40 million, for me, would have been a steal. But Bertrand on a free for Leicester is going to go down as good business as well. So yeah, I'd put them in the B category. Do you know what I mean?
If you're getting Premier League experience and you're not paying the big fee that you would usually pay for a Premier League player, that's always going to be a bonus, isn't it?
Absolutely. Liverpool, they did their business nice and early, bringing in Frenchman Ibrahima Konate from RB Leipzig. Perhaps could have done with reinforcing the midfield department a little bit. They've lost Gigi Wijnaldum to PSG, and Henderson's another year older, had injury problems last year. Naby Keita and Thiago Alcantara would be expecting to have much better seasons this year. So they were fairly underwhelming in this transfer market. Maybe they'll have a bigger move in January, see where they are. You know what I mean? If they need a big player in January, let's say they're fifth or sixth, they'll probably make a big signing then.
They've been waiting for Van Dijk to come back for a whole season, haven't they? So that's probably where their focus is. Do you know what I mean? Instead of getting these mad big money signings in, they're probably like, let's just reinforce the team that won us the league and minus Wijnaldum and that. So I think, again, when it comes to the big teams, and not even essentially the big teams, but a lot of it is holding on to your best players. You just see so many players going to and from, weakening the squad overall. You know, it is almost as good as signing someone new, holding on to your top boys.
So maybe a B for them? C plus, yeah, C minus or C plus, something like that. So Man City, does Grealish represent great value for money for you? They already have so many attacking options in there. They spent 100 million on him. They could have persevered in the market and, you know, gone for a striker and paid, you know, sort of 80, 90 million for somebody. They're always going to get charged a premium, aren't they, Man City? But yeah. I feel like they've missed out slightly. Ferran Torres seems to be doing all right in that position, doesn't he, now? And obviously, they've got Gabriel Jesus still there. So, you know, it's not the end of the world. But, I mean, Mbappe, why wasn't he considered an option?
You're doubling your money there, aren't you? To be fair, it's the same with Kane. And to assess whether 100 million for Jack Grealish is worth it, if they win the Champions League this year, absolutely.
And they're only spending much, yeah.
They're only one game away last season, so
yeah. And you know, obviously the Harry Kane rumours aren't going anywhere fast either, are they?
Yeah, exactly, man. I reckon they've just put that one on like the back burner for a little bit. If it comes down to the crunch, they'll definitely get back on that Harry Kane thing. But it depends how his season goes as well, man. Like if he carries on, I don't want to say he's playing badly because, you know, he scored again, and you know there's only that. He just looks a little bit disjointed. Mm. And if he manages to replicate any kind of the form that we've seen in the past, they'll be knocking on his door next year, I reckon.
All right. And Manchester United, we're going to move on to them, who I think, and I'm sure you won't argue with me, but you might do. I think that they've had the best transfer window out of all the teams in the Premier League this year. They've brought back one of the greatest players of our generation for peanuts, for nothing. What 15 million quid or something? 12 million quid. Plus his wage is going to be a lot of money as well. But honestly, the fact that they've spent that amount of money on a 36-year-old Ronaldo, we said he's like a 28-year-old any other player in the Premier League. So bringing him in, bringing in Jadon Sancho, young, exciting winger, obviously had to break the bank slightly for him, 70-odd million. Rafael Varane, who I think that's a great signing. Who's, you know, won World Cups. He's won loads of trophies at Real Madrid. He'll bolster that defence, and he's still at a good age, 28, slotting alongside Maguire really nicely. I'd say one of the best windows for United in years, man.
Yeah, no arguments from me at all. They've elevated their squad in every area of the pitch, minus goalkeeper.
That's what you want, isn't it? You want to upgrade the ideal transfer window, and they've spent less than Arsenal, by the way. So the ideal transfer window would be improve your defense, improve your midfield, improve your attack, and they've done that, and they've spent considerably, you know, a relatively low amount of money, so 120 million, which, you know, isn't that much for a club of their stature, but they've improved it for the foreseeable future as well. Rafael Varane, surely they'd be able to get 4 years out of him. Jadon Sancho, they'll get as many years out of him as they want until, or if they want to sell him on. And then Ronaldo, you can see him getting at least two or three very good years out of him. And then who knows after that? Who knows how long he wants to keep on playing, because he doesn't look like he's going to stop anytime soon, does he?
They've smashed it, haven't they, Man United?
Yeah, so Newcastle brought in Joe Willock, who was on loan from Arsenal. So another player that they've let slip through the net, another youth player. God, it's just a beatdown on Arsenal. Like, I'm not even doing it deliberately, man. It's just like, comes up every time.
Honestly, it's banana skins all over the place.
It comes
man.
Up naturally, just naturally comes up. And they've signed this lad, Munoz, on loan, who I don't know much about. I felt like Newcastle owners needed to press on a little bit more this window and get players in that are going to change the club's fortunes, because I'll be surprised if Newcastle aren't in the bottom five at Christmas. So I've gave them a C.
I'd like them to stay up for no other reason than I've got this random arbitrary attachment to them.
You got that with Blackburn as well, didn't you? Yeah. Well, you used to be a Blackburn fan, didn't you?
Yeah, in year seven, when I picked the name out of the hat, and then I was like, nah, fuck this, I'm supporting Arsenal.
Back it's going to be happening again, man. You're going to be a Villa fan in 12 months when Arsenal get relegated, aren't you?
I want Arsenal to get relegated so Blues and Arsenal can play each other, and I can go and get in St Andrews for a quid once they open them stands back up.
When Troy Deeney's got his wish. Right, so Norwich signed 12 players for a total sum of £53 million, which ain't bad going, really. Loan signings of Kabak on loan from Liverpool, the player that they randomly signed from Schalke for like £2 million last window. Brandon Williams and Billy Gilmore represent clever recruitment for me on loan from Man United and Chelsea, respectively. Josh Sargent, a young American striker who's been performing well in the Bundesliga. So that looks a good sign. I'm going to give them a B, because I think if you can get 12 players in and really kind of like, they're doing one of certain recruitment policies you see when teams get up from the Championship. Some teams spend over their limit, like Villa did in their first season back, I think, when they spent like £125 million, which is a lot of money for a team that just got promoted. Some teams do a Brentford, where they keep their core squad and they'll spend like a considerable amount of money on a couple of players just to bolster it. And then there's teams that will sign loads of players for not very much, like Norwich are doing. So there's certain recruitment strategies that teams go through when they get promoted from the Championship. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't on each one of those strategies. But I think Norwich, I'd say they probably got it right, because even if they do get relegated, they still might be all right in it. They always seem to be. They're a proper yo-yo club, aren't they?
With getting 12 players in, there's always the danger of struggling to assimilate so many new players into the team. And I think that's the only danger you run there. I agree with you. Billy Gilmore, the one that Graeme Souness and the boys were like jizzing all over when he played against England. So like, apparently he's highly regarded on loan from Chelsea again. But it's not like they don't churn out bad players really from their academy. So that's probably a good move. And was it Josh Sargent, American striker with an American name, at ease, boys? I think they're in danger of going down anyway.
Yeah, I'd be surprised if they're not in that bottom three, come the end of the season. Southampton, not sure Adam Armstrong is going to be a good replacement with Danny Ings. It was great in the Championship, but £16 million still feels like a lot of money for those type of players. Walcott on a free, could be hit or miss, and a couple of players from Europe who we aren't sure will improve the squad. So I gave them a C+, just underneath the B, because I just don't think that Adam Armstrong is going to be a fair replacement for someone of Danny Ings' caliber.
Yeah, it goes back to that same argument, isn't it? Like, Ings is going to be a huge miss. He's a proven goal scorer in the Premier League. So there aren't that many of those type of players around. So if Armstrong is one of those players and you manage to get him for £16 million, it's one of those ones you'll have to see at the end of the season, isn't it?
Yeah. Tottenham, a couple of loan signings from Atlanta and Hill from Sevilla. Saar from Metz for 22 and 15 million respectively. Relatively unknown quantities, if you ask me. I'm sure people that are very sort of like acquainted with European football might know a little bit more about them. But it'll be interesting to see how they adapt to life in the Premier League. Royal from Barcelona comes in to replace Serge Aurier, who, I'll be honest, I'd never heard of him. He was on loan, I think, at Real Betis last season. And Serge Aurier, who's had his contract mutually terminated, and it's been reported that he might be going to Arsenal, which would probably be their best signing of the transfer window. Tottenham avoided the marquee signings this season, but managed to keep hold of the talisman. What sort of mark do you give them?
It's got to be, just for keeping hold of Kane, even a diminished Kane, £160 million, £170 million. what they possibly would have done with that kind of money. Remember when they sold Bale a few years ago?
Yeah,
you'd expect them to.
Yeah,
and it didn't quite work out for them, so they've probably dodged a little bullet there. So a B, I'll go for a B.
I agree. I think Daniel Levy's done. He's done pretty well with that. Watford combined a mixture of experience and players with points to prove for very little money. One of those recruitment strategies from the Championship that we spoke about. Have spent $16 million and managed to bring in Josh King, Moussa Sissoko and Danny Rose for $16 million, and a couple of youngsters from the lower leagues. Banging business. Sometimes this works out well for teams. Sometimes it works out horrendously. So it'd be interesting to see how they build on their relatively good start. I'd give them a B, but I'm actually talking myself into thinking that's an A. Like Josh King, he was at Everton, wasn't he? He was at Bournemouth, and then I think he was at Everton. Moussa Sissoko, I think he's still got a few years left in him. And I think he's
Danny Rose is a good signing, man.
Danny Rose is only 31. So, and he was at Newcastle last season, I think on loan. I'm not sure how he was performing, but he got games. So I think that's a pretty good window for Watford.
Got rid of Troy Deeney though. Boo.
Boo. After 11 years, what a legend. He's gonna be class of Blues. So West Ham, Kurt Zouma, good signing for them. Spent a lot of money on him though. I think it was like 30 odd. They managed to keep hold of Declan Rice, which I think is going to boost their grade. Croatian Nikola Vlasic. He's got a massive point to prove after signing him for $25 million. He was a bit of a flop when he made his move to Everton a few years ago. But I think Areola is a good, solid addition in the goalkeeping department on loan from PSG after his good season with Fulham last year. So what would you give them?
I'd say a B as well. Zouma's a good signing, man.
Yeah, for I think sure. He's a great player. I think he's a great centre-back. I think he's going to do well for him.
And again, it's the same thing again we've said for the last few teams. Keeping hold of your marquee players. Declan Rice, what a player he is. Scored the other night again against Hungary. So, yeah, can't fault him, can you?
Nope. So, lastly, it's Wolves. So, they haven't really spent much. Failed to bring in Renato Sanchez on loan last game of the season, which I think would have been an incredible signing. Started the season pretty woefully and looked very toothless in attack. Which is something they have addressed, but with unproven players from some poor European leagues. So it's hard to really give them a good mark. I'm seeing they've had a poor start to the season. They lost their coach, Nuno Espirito, to Spurs last season. So it's really difficult to give them a good grade and to see where they're sort of headed.
Yeah, they need to steady the ship in terms of their management situation at the moment. But for me, United got off really luckily to beat them. Do you know what I mean? I wouldn't say they're toothless. Maybe a little bit like Brighton, where they're creating the chances, we're not scoring. So hopefully that will level itself out over the course of the season.
All right, fair enough. So that's pretty much it. So we need to really start thinking about keeping a league table on these quiz questions. We're just you're 1-0 up anyway, innit? So if I be, how many do I need to beat? How many do I need to get to?
I think I got like 1 point last week.
Oh yeah, you got the last one, didn't you?
But you know what? To be fair, this isn't an overly difficult one, but there's a couple of Yeah. Anyway, we'll see how you get on, innit?
2 points takes the win. If I can win, I'll go on and crack on.
You read it?
Yep. Go on.
All right. Arsenal were the top spenders in the transfer window this season, splashing 158.6 million on a Sunday league team. But can you tell me which club holds the all-time highest spending record in the Premier League? And a bonus point if you can give me the amount to the nearest 10 million
in that season. So,
no, all time, the highest ever spenders in the Premier League.
Adding all of it up together?
No, just in one transfer window.
One transfer window. Blackburn, Rovers.
Is that your guess?
Yeah.
It's Man City.
I was going to say Man City with like billions, but I fucked that one up.
I think, you know, I think you did that. I think you thought I was trying to judish her. The only reason...
I was thinking in one window, innit? I was thinking Blackburn Rovers when they bought the league with like Sutton and like...
It was City in the 17-18 season with 278.7 million.
In a single window. Okay, all right. Yeah.
Sorry about that. If there was any ambiguity of the question.
Because I was thinking like the question I was trying to ask was like, do you take like inflation into account? So like if
I'm not an economist.
If Blackburn spent like 50 million in like 95, what would that'd probably be worth potentially more than, come on man, that's a bit of a fucking Judas question that is.
Nah, you're trying to be too clever. for your own good. Straightforward. All right,
go on.
Question number two. The Paralympics closing ceremony is this Sunday. It's an admirably inclusive competition and one I've completely ignored. And in what year did the first ever Paralympics Games take place?
All right. I have absolutely no idea about this, but I'm going to... Can I just guess the decade? It's 60s. Yeah. All right. So it's the same year, isn't it? So which... about 10 seconds. 1966. Now it's a World Cup year, 1967.
It was 1960. Oh, son. Unlucky. But that was... that's either you know it or you don't, isn't it, that one?
So that was... No, that wasn't a World Cup year, was it? It was 2 years. Yeah, it's 2 years after World Cup. 1966 was World Cup, then 62. All right, yeah, yeah. I'm glad I got the decade right, at least.
You got the decade right. I'll do half a point for that if you want.
Yeah. Right. No, we'll see, we'll see. I need to get at least two. I've had a terrible showing on the first question.
Question three. After a stellar European Championship, England's World Cup campaign began this week. Our current squad gives us cause for optimism, but can you tell me, how many times have England failed to qualify for the World Cup?
So I know there was once, 1994, that was when it was in America. I think there was another time sort of in the 40s or something as well. I wonder if there's one more. I think we failed to qualify for the Euros, didn't we? Was it 2008, 2012? World Cup. I'm going to go twice.
Is that your final answer?
Yeah.
So close again.
Three times.
Three times.
Yeah.
1974, West Germany. 1978, Argentina. And as you said, 1994 in the USA.
Yeah, that's so the 70s
was
remember.
A bad decade. Bad decade.
Yeah, I was going to say, time. Yeah, fucking hell.
Mate, I expected you to get that one.
I know. I should have got it.
All right. Now, on to question four. The Solheim Cup gets underway this weekend in Ohio with teams USA and Europe battling out for the club swinging supremacy. And can you name me the captain of each team?
Absolutely not. No, I can't. That is...
That's your wheelhouse, man. It's golf.
The Solheim Cup. You mean the Ryder Cup?
No, the Solheim Cup is the women's one, isn't it?
Oh, is it the women's? Okay. So the US women's captain, Europe's winning captain. Yeah. Women's captain. All right, USA. You might have to give me a bit longer on this. Who'd be the USA? Is it that Nelly Korda? Is she the US women's?
No. The USA captain's got a man's name.
A man's name? Europe. Mate, that's a fucking tough question, man.
I've stumped you, man.
Massively.
You'd at least guess one of them.
I could have had a go. I could have had a go at the Ryder Cup, like the Ryder Cup captains, but that's fucking tough, man.
The Europe captain is Catriona Matthew and the USA captain is Pat Hurst.
I haven't heard of either of them, mate. Women's golf, obviously not my forte, like.
Terrible. You're not being very inclusive, Bishop. You should be ashamed of yourself.
Mate, I'm having a fucking shock. All right, we're going to have to cancel this quiz because I can't even get a question right.
All right, question five. This week, the imperious Cristiano Ronaldo passed Ali Dyer's international goal scoring record with two late strikes against the Republic of Ireland, taking him to 111 goals in total for Portugal. It's a predictably obscure bunch who make up the rest of the top five in this list. And I'll give you a point for every player and every country you can name for me.
You know what? And I've looked at this list recently.
There's one in there you should get, man.
I can't believe you gave me, because I would have got Ali Dyer. Obviously, Iran, wasn't it? Pele's just outside him, I think. I think he's like seventh or something.
Yeah, he is, yeah. I can tell you've looked at the list recently.
I know there's a Malaysian geezer there. So do I get a point for that?
Yes, you do get a point
for
that.
I do not know his name.
Well done.
Who else was there? It's players from those sort of neck of the woods, isn't it? Like there's teams in sort of those sort of places where it's obviously there's not many great teams playing there, so they score a lot of goals.
Player's name is synonymous with goal scoring.
I think is there an African player in there as well? I think
if you narrow it down to the country, you can have another point.
Cameroon.
Nah.
Not Roger Miller, no. He played for ages. I know he played till like 42. I wish I had a good memory. I've literally looked at this in the last week or so.
Drinking cans at 9 a.m, kid.
Yeah, it's probably it. And the jet lag. I'll blame it on something. Nah, fucked it. Go on.
You got a point out of that though. I'm quite impressed. I didn't think you'd get anything.
What was the Malaysian player name?
Mokhtar Dahari.
Oh, is it? Yeah.
Got 89 goals for Malaysia. Next one on the list is Ferenc Puskas for Hungary.
Yeah.
84 goals.
Yeah.
And the last one, Godfrey Chitalu for Zambia with 79 goals. So,
Zambia.
Tough one there, mate.
Yeah, so Pushkas. Yeah, should have got that. You gave me a little bit of a clue because the Pushkas Award's synonymous with goal scoring. Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably should have got that, but if I was switching on. The 30 seconds thing's tough as well. But all in all, I should have got that number one. I overthought that one. Paralympics one was a bit of a guess. Should have got the number three as well, realistically. Yeah, all in all, another poor showing from Bissett. And that's a draw, I'd say. You know what I mean? Draw for this week. So point apiece. You move on to four, I move on to one.
Oh, I'll take that, you know. I didn't think I was going to be able to scrap anything from that. So nice result for the lad. Oh, sweet.
Absolutely. All right, let's move on to the combat sports.
The only thing to talk about from last week is Jake Paul and Tyron Woodley. So it was a dull fight, 8 rounds, went the distance. Jake Paul looked out on his feet for the last 5 rounds, I'd say. But Woodley still couldn't get close enough to land big shots. At one point, he punched him hard enough where Jake Paul went through the ropes and people made a big deal out of that. But realistically, Jake Paul's foot movement, his longer punches and his ability to just stay out of the way brought him victory in the fight. It wasn't the most entertaining thing to watch. And I don't understand why. But people seemed outraged by it, like MMA people, boxing people. What were you expecting, really? For me, I thought Woodley was going to charge at him and try and unload power on him early. But what actually happened was, I think he was depending on Jake Paul getting tired. And once that rhythm, after the third and fourth round, you could see Woodley up his activity. But he'd already got into a pattern where he wasn't punching much. And that kind of conservative approach is what cost him in the last few years in the UFC. So I feel like it was just this cocktail of like horrible ingredients that just lent itself to a boring fight. And I mean, fair play to Jake Paul for even battling that kind of exhaustion. And Tyron Woodley obviously hits pretty hard. He managed to hold on. And I don't think it's any coincidence that after the fight, Jake Paul was talking about, oh, I'm probably not going to box anymore because he was in a real fight for the first time, even though it weren't the best to watch.
Yeah.
You know, fatigue does... It makes cowards of all men, as they say. So.
But as you say, though, but the people that are watching this and criticising it, the sort of like MMA buds and the experts and all that. But as you say, I'm not sure quite what they expect. You've got a 42-year-old ex-UFC champion who's having his first professional bout. You've got a YouTuber that basically started up boxing just because he could and he knew he could make money out of it. And it's kind of a passion of his. And he's only had 4 fights and he's fought nobody, really. Ben Askren, who had no real business being in a boxing ring anyway. So did they expect some like majestic encounter and it to be like, you know, two blokes going toe to toe and standing in there and like destroying each other or what?
To be fair, I expected more from Woodley in terms of his activity in the beginning, but I also agree with his game plan. Like this kid's never been past 2 rounds. Drag him into that area and see what happens and then start hitting him with the big shots and then try and compound the damage to him with his tiredness and then hitting him hard. Like I thought it was a pretty smart game plan, to be honest.
Did you buy into the idea that potentially Woodley didn't put the finishing touches on that? I think it was the fourth round. I think it was like he sort of hit him on the back of the head, didn't it? And he sort of fell into the ropes. Do you buy into the fact that he sort of laid off him then? He could have finished him.
No, he tried to hit him again. He tried to hit him with a right hook and it glanced off Jake Paul's shoulder. Mm. Like the shot there was the uppercut, but it's easier said than done. I'm watching a slow motion replay and he's in there in the moment. I can see why people would say, oh, he might have thrown the fight because there were a lot of instances in that fight where they were standing off each other at distance. And I think Tyron Woodley didn't want to be standing in there close with him. He wanted to be walking him down and then throwing clusters of shots and then getting out of there. But Jake Paul's foot movement was decent enough. He was able to evade that stuff. I just feel like it wasn't a life or death fight. It wasn't a world championship match. So the intensity from Woodley's side, it wasn't going to be the same thing as we've seen in the past. And, you know, if you're making a career high payday for fighting a novice, you're not going to be that bothered, I don't think. You can say embarrassment and all that all you want, but there's so much small print involved with this fight that it's like you can just write it off any way you choose, to be honest. Fair play to Woodley. Got the bag. I think got like close to $1 million or something, more than he ever made in the UFC for a single fight.
Which is bizarre. Jake Paul,
Same. No, it's, you know, it's all good. I'm happy he's getting paid. As far as the result goes, it doesn't mean anything in the wider context. I mean, for the hardcore boxing fans, there was Daniel Dubois and Tommy Fury on the undercard as well. But Daniel Dubois looked especially leaky in his defense. I don't know who he was fighting, but he pulled off two counter right hands that would have, if thrown by someone like Dillian White, never mind Joshua or Fury or any of those boys, he'd have got knocked clean out. So there's definitely a long way to go for Daniel Dubois in terms of his development.
Yeah, he's obviously had that loss to Joe Joyce, didn't he? Where he had a large bulbus.
He broke his orbital bone, didn't he?
Yeah, on his eye.
But it's not that that concerns me. To me, he looks up for the fight regardless. It's the defensive lapses, technique is the problem with him. It's not his size or his willingness to fight. It's his hands are just around his chest the whole time. And because he's not a middleweight, he hasn't got the fleetness of foot to get out of range like he would do if you've got a low guard. So I think there's a lot of work to be done there. The main thing with the boxing is this week, man, the rematch between Josh Warrington and Mauricio Lara. And I rewatched the first fight this morning and I was astounded that that fight was allowed to go past the third or fourth round whenever he got knocked down. That should have been stopped there and then. The referee on Warrington's corner, who's his dad, by the way, his trainer, they failed him. They failed him on that night because he was taking heavy shots from the first round. And when he went down hard. And when he got up, he wasn't recovered.
And yeah, we spoke about that at the time, didn't we? We spoke about, you know, do referees give a certain level of advantage in terms of like calling the fight to the favorite or to the champion. And his belts went on the line on that occasion. Unfortunately for Lara, were they?
No, he vacated.
He vacated it a few months before, didn't he?
So Kid Galahad has just won the belt that he vacated against Jazza Dickens. So he's got no title now. And here's the thing that gets me about the PED conversation. There are other factors that put boxers in more danger than PEDs. There's no way that Josh Warrington should have been allowed to continue in that fight. But because he was the favourite, because he's a matchroom fighter, and because he's got world title opportunities coming up, they put him in danger. Mm. And here's how much of a hard knock Warrington is. He was giving it to Lara in the fifth round. I think it's the fourth when he got knocked down. In the fifth, I had him possibly winning. He was landing good hooks, good combinations. Still, his legs were gone. But he's such a consummate... What's the word now? He's a consummate professional anyway, but he was so unwilling to relinquish his undefeated record. He just didn't want to get beat. The fact is, on the night, it was a combination of, I think there was a little bit of, he was a little bit too relaxed mentally. I think he chose the wrong tactic standing in there. I think he got hurt early and I think he had a little bit of a prideful rush. I think he tried to overwhelm Lara with volume instead of staying at distance, which is perhaps the more advisable route to take to victory. And he was trying to stay in the fight all the way up into that brutal knockout in the ninth round, and it was a brutal knockout. Lara, he looks and fights like a man who knows he's got power. He's not bothered about getting hit. He hasn't got the greatest speed in the world, but he likes to throw with people. Every time Warrington let off more than three punches, he was throwing hooks with him, and Warrington's head was getting rocked back. You could hear him punching his ribs and his stomach and all that, man. He was, after the sixth or the seventh round, in my notes, I was like, this is getting uncomfortable to watch. Now, maybe part of that was because I know what's coming, but I also think that he was hitting him hard consistently from start to finish. And the knockout is like he landed three or four left hooks in a row, put a right hand to the body, then a left hook to the head to finish. And Warrington just, it was bad, man. Do you know what I mean? And I don't want to watch. I mean, I suppose it's hypocritical of me to say that because that's what I watch boxing for, that kind of human drama. But it shouldn't have been allowed to go that far. And I really think the measures that are in place and the people who put them in place, they failed him on that night.
How much do you think Josh Warrington's lead up, his inactivity in lead up to that first fight, and perhaps, you know, taking sort of Mauricio Lara lightly because he was a fairly unknown quantity going into that fight. How much do you think that had an effect on the sort of the result of the fight? And do you think that now Warrington's probably taking Lara a lot more seriously, or you should hope so, and a proper training camp building up to it? Do you think that's going to have an effect, and how do you see this fight going?
I think there are a lot of factors that affected Warrington's performance in the first fight. The inactivity, 16 months off, that's never a good thing for a fighter. I think the crowd, the lack of a crowd in the first part was a massive factor. We've seen how different football's been since crowds have been allowed back. And Warrington's got one of the most raucous fan bases in the entire world of boxing. I also think that Warrington's got this reputation as being a gym rat, consummate professional, as we said before. But similar to Scott Quigg, I do think there comes a point of diminishing returns when you spend so much time in the gym. You're always running the risk of leaving too much in your training camp. So there's a lot of balancing acts to be done here for Warrington if he's going to win. I definitely think he can win the rematch because there were times, even when his legs were absolutely gone in the first fight, that he was hitting Lara with jabs, straight punches. I think straight punches and staying on the periphery. Don't go inside with this guy. Don't throw hooks. Don't throw long combinations. Just avoid all that shit. I think the more boring the fight is, the more it will favour Warrington. I don't know who's going to win because I can definitely see Warrington getting dragged into a scrap. Definitely, I can see that. But I also think if he fights a disciplined fight, an uncharacteristic fight, granted, but if he stays disciplined and he's not bothered about putting on a show for people and he doesn't let his pride overwhelm his sense, I think he could definitely win it, man.
And but that's where really the crowd might be a disadvantage because if he feels that the crowd want him to step it up a gear and put a lot more pressure on Lara, that could possibly lead him into avenues where he's going to get hurt. And as you can see from that first fight, Lara can punish him if he doesn't get his tactics right, and he doesn't, you know, he doesn't sort of manage the fight in a way that suits himself, then he could really fall into some big holes.
Yeah, I'm gassed, man. And if
you get me excited to watch it now as well.
Oh, it's going to be sick. And if he wins this fight against Lara, he hasn't got a title, but he's in that conversation with Kid Galahad and Lee Wood as well. Look, a round robin at featherweight there. Loads of business to be done. Sick. So that is a nice little card topper for Eddie and the boys. On the undercard, Conor Benn, Adrian Granados. We spoke about this a few weeks ago on the pod. Adrian Granados is a well-seasoned welterweight campaigner, and it's a very good step up for Conor Benn. I expect Conor Benn to win this fight because I think everything's in his favour, his age, his style. The fact that Granados is on a bit of a slide, he's fought Sean Porter, he's fought Adrian Broner, he's fought that calibre of opponent, Robert Easter Jr., and he's always come up short. He's got the style where he takes a lot of punches as well, and I feel like this is good matchmaking. I expect Conor Benn to come through, but I also wouldn't disregard Granados' chances entirely. I thought he beat Broner myself a few years ago, but that was a few years ago and quite a few hard rounds ago as well. So the last notable bout on the card is Katie Taylor, the undisputed queen at lightweight. I mean, she's 35 now, gold medalist in London 2012. She's 18-0, bar two close fights with the Belgian Delphine Bassoon. She's looked pretty much untouchable. The only problem with her, as far as I can see, is that she does have one style. She's not exactly a one-trick pony, but she has one style where she likes to throw lots of hooks in clusters. When she gets on a jab, she looks like no one can touch her, but she doesn't like fighting that way. She's energetic. She likes being in there. She likes trading encounters and slipping and sliding on the inside. A little bit like a Mexican fighter. I've never heard of her opponent. Is it Jennifer Han or Jennifer Han? Never heard of her. I can't assess her chances either way based on that. I would expect, given the lightness of women's boxing in general, that this is one in Katie Taylor's favour. And I always like watching her, and I always got a bit of a soft spot for Katie Taylor, man.
Yeah, what does she do? Because obviously she's coming up against these fighters. As you said, I think that the Belgian sort of... I think she's a bit... Was she like in her 40s or something? I can't remember. She's getting on, wasn't she? Did she come in last minute for somebody?
She was the champion, I think. She had a title belt, I think. But... yeah, it's just a bad style matchup for her. She's one of them people who could take punches all night long and keep coming. And that is exactly who you don't want to fight if you're Katie Taylor.
She seems to be sweeping like everybody at a side that she comes across. You know, would there be something, you know, would it be marketable for her and for women's boxing if they did sort of, you know, sort of catch weight with Clarissa Shields, something like that? Do you know what I mean? Like a big fight, like a big matchup fight for them. And that really sort of like boost the interest, I think, in women's boxing as well.
Well, they were talking about that, but I think they're too far away from each other in weight, really. I think with Sky now, because Slimy Eddie's gone to the zone with Matt Droom and the lads, they've just made an allegiance with Top Rank, and they've signed Clarissa Shields and her amateur rival, Savannah Marshall. Savannah Marshall is the current middleweight champion. She's the only person to beat Clarissa Shields in the amateurs. So I think their rivalry is going to do a lot more for... Yeah. cultivating that kind of interest for boxing fans. But I think Katie Taylor now, she probably hasn't got that many years left. It's just time to enjoy her. Watch her just beat up these girls that are coming in. I don't care if I don't know the opponent for this one. It's like a squash match for me, isn't it? So
yeah,
it's all good. I've got no complaints there. But yeah, this weekend as well, the UFC's got Darren Till, there's Tom Aspinall and Paddy Pimblett, all from the UK, all from the North East, really. So two Scousers, one Mank. And, you know, it's an interesting time for them because Darren Till is 18-3. I think he's been quite underwhelming myself, but he's got, is it Derek Brunson now who's going to fight? And if he wins his fight, he's in title contention at middleweight. So they're really giving him a hard push despite underwhelming performances on his part.
Would you say he's Tom lost Aspinall. Three of the last four? Is that what it, I'm sh- is that
yeah.
What it's only was it him that yeah, lost yeah. three of the last four, yeah.
So he lost to Tyron Woodley, big up. And he lost to Jorge Masvidal, beat Calvin Gastelum, and then he lost to Robert Whittaker. Now, look, there's no shame. He's operating at the top tier there.
Yeah.
But in terms of bankability, becoming an elite fighter, for me, he's not quite on that level. And there's no shame in that. And also, I think at middleweight, because Adesanya's beat everyone else, that's quite a marketable fight to make. If Darren Till makes short work of Bronson, that's, you know, just run the highlights and just, you know, you can get on with it from there, can't you? Tom Aspinall, there's been a lot of hype behind him from a long time. For me, he's just a normal-looking heavyweight. I don't see what's so... obviously, I support him. He's from the UK and all that. But for me, not really that bothered about him. Paddy Pimblett is doing my head in. He's all over my YouTube feed. I've watched interviews with him saying Scousers don't get knocked out, this, that and the other. It's like, mate, have you never heard of David Price? Have you never seen Tony Bellew against Alexander Usyk? Stop talking out your ass, man. But I also want him to do well because obviously it's like from the UK.
Yeah.
But I just don't...
They're conflict of interest there, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I'm conflicted in my own mind. But yeah, so they're going to push him. I imagine his opponent, Luigi Vendramini, I think this is a good matchup for him. It'd be stupid of the UFC to put him in with like a genuine threat here. And we'll see how he gets on because he was 16-3 in Cage Warriors. A lot of hype behind him. A lot of good chokes, submissions from the bottom. I don't know what his stand-up's like, to be honest. But the UFC are quite kind to British fighters, you know. I think they like the fan base to travel. It's like the whole Ricky Hatton thing, isn't it? They know we're going to travel. They know we're going to show support on social media and all that. So, yeah, I think...
So they don't throw him in the deep end too early.
Yeah, not really. No. But, yeah, it's a good card. Good card for the UK. And I think there's going to be a few... I think Darren Till is really going to shine against Derek Brunson, to be honest. I think that is tailor-made for him. And, you know, all the best to all of them. And that's about it for the previews, man, this week.
Yeah, so I think the boxing's going to be the one to watch, the one to tune into, certainly, this weekend, isn't it?
Yeah, defo, man. I just can't wait, man. I was excited for the Warrington fight anyway, but re-watching it this morning, just salivating, man. Absolutely salivating. I hope he does... I don't want to see the same kind of brutal beating, but that's kind of what I'm tuning in for as well. Another conflict of interest.
Yeah, definitely whetting the appetite. All right. Yes, nice one. So next week, we will probably not have a full-length episode. Yeah, we'll probably have an NFL preview because that season starts next Sunday. So that'll be it. And then we'll be back to normal the following week.
Sweet. And if I can record something individually as well, to add to it, just to get a little bit of a lengthier episode out there, I'll try and sort it out.
Yeah, a review of the sort of boxing, review of the Warrington fight, review of the UFC, and we can sort of just clip them in or put them up separately as sort of their own little things.
Yeah, nice.
All right, sounds good. Lovely to see you again, mate, even though it's virtually this time.
I wish I was having a beer at 10 a.m. with you kids. Happy birthday again.
I'm starting to slur my words already, like, do you know what I mean? Might have to go for a little nap.
Do a few press-ups, have a glass of water. Just carry on the session, mate.
Not doing nothing to do with exercise. I'm never doing exercise again after you've had your way with me. That sounds a bit weird, but
all right, sounds.
All right, sounds in a bit, man.